Citizen Sounds, a diverse collection of sounds and stories from our researchers, educators, and students, sharing knowledge and insight to make a difference in Leicester and the world. We are Citizens of Change, University of Leicester. I'm Tari King, Professor of Public Engagement, and today I'm talking to John Remedios, who is Professor of Earth Observation Science here at the University of Leicester and Executive Director of the National Center for Earth Observation. So I'm going to be talking to John about his research about using Earth observation for climate and environmental science. But first of all, John, how did you come to be in this area of research and what brought you to the University of Leicester?
Well, my path, I suppose, started out at the University of Oxford, where I was an undergraduate. And I guess like many students, it's what takes your attention at the time. So I had two lucky things. One, I kind of cared about what rainfall was falling on my head and did an essay in my second year about the effects of weather modification, whether you could actually see clouds and cause extra rainfall. And I really enjoyed it. So I thought, well, actually, I like this atmosphere part of physics. I want to do something with the physics that actually makes a difference now rather than in the long term. So I started a PhD, a DPhil, as they call it in Oxford, way back in 1985. And that second moment was a really exciting moment. In December 1985, it was the announcement of the discovery of the ozone hole in the Antarctic. And that was just unbelievable because what we were working on at the time was a satellite mission to look at chemistry of ozone in exactly that part of the atmosphere, not just in the poles, but globally. And so, wow, you know, here you are starting your PhD, trying to ask the questions, and suddenly it's all happening around you. It's both frightening and intriguing at the same time. It's a very odd mixture. So that really set me on that path because I could instantly see that whilst I was buried in the physics, trying to work on how this satellite instrument would work, how do we actually use it, but seeing already that people were really interested in the results. They wanted to know why there was a hole. They wanted to know what chemistry was going on. They wanted to know, did it affect me where I was? You know, here we are in the UK, in northern latitudes. This is happening in the poles, all that sort of stuff. So that really got me into that satellite sensing area. And we worked on, the problem of ozone chemistry throughout the 90s, and with good results, as it turned out. We understood that chlorine was the culprit, and over time, industry responded with new substitutes. So what next? So one of the things that we did at Oxford was we were really trying to use infrared technology, so that sort of invisible radiation that we sense from a hot source. And the Earth is actually surprisingly warm if you have a sensitive enough instrument. So looking down at the Earth from space rather than looking outwards. And you're seeing something at about 25, 27 degrees C, maybe a bit lower, but about 300 Kelvin in scientific units. And that signal is actually the same as the signal that you see from the greenhouse effect. It's that change in the infrared component leaving the Earth that controls what our surface temperature is. So it was a sort of logical thing to think, what next? And the really big thing that was happening in the UK at that time was an instrument called the Along Track Scanning Radiometer, which had been actually designed by a group of universities, including Oxford, but Leicester also, and a place called the Rutherford Appleton Lab. And the professor who was the PI of that, the principal investigator of that instrument, had actually moved to Leicester in 93 and set up a remote sensing and earth observation group. So I was looking for a job, actually. I decided I had enough years of temporary small contracts and was wanting to really make it as an academic. And a post came up at Leicester. And I knew Professor David Llewellyn Jones from those early 90s years. So I applied here and found myself working on this climate instrument. And what we were working on then was, and have been working on ever since, is the surface temperature. Can we really measure it accurately and consistently? Can we be confident that climate really is changing? It was the first chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Sir John Horton, who said, can't we do this from space as well as from the ground so we can be really sure of what we're measuring? It's taken us a long time since to analyse the data, decades, but we've done it. And we have some of the most precise instruments in the world now doing it. That first ATSR became the second ATSR, became the advanced long track scanning radiometer, became the sea and land surface temperature radiometer, and still operating today, 30 years later.
I love hearing about these little, because you go along in your career and tiny little things will send you off on a particular track, and that seems to be exactly what happened to you. You suddenly have these little things that happen, and off you go. And then you're involved in something where you've got these kind of these applications, real world applications that you're able to use your work to do. And it's kind of extraordinary what you're working on now, having started kind of early on in physics. So, I mean, I that's the thing. I think people have a really good idea of the university has got a really strong reputation in space research. But normally you kind of think of that looking up. But as you said, this is looking down. And actually, we're really well known for it. So presumably it started with that early group. So in the 1990s, is that where it all sort of started?
It did. And one of the inspirations behind it already, right at the start, was that actually when you did that looking down at the Earth, you didn't need just one type of academic. You needed a range of academics. So you needed your physicists, but you needed your chemists, you needed your geographers, and they all had to be involved. So right in 1993, the intention was to set up that cross-department collaboration. And it's thrived ever since. But I think we've been very lucky at Leicester with the types of people that have wanted to come here and work. And they've all gone on to great things, still working at Leicester, but taking on responsibilities at national and international level, which means Leicester is known, you know, across the UK and in Europe and globally for the work that it does in this area. And it's not just what I talked about, the surface temperatures, but for example, Professor Bautzer works on, you know, forests and trees. That how do you measure the carbon in those forests and trees? What happens if you destroy a forest? What happens if you put a forest in? Does that really make a difference? And then we've been able to link the various strands of research that we've done. So Professor Bautzer is looking at the forest and Professor Bosch is looking at the carbon dioxide change in the atmosphere as a result, et cetera, et cetera. And it nicely hangs together. But yeah, I think you're right about the way in which we pick up events that people really care about and our research is really relevant straight away. It takes a long time to come to the results often, but you always have that feeling and that understanding that there's a question that people want to answer and it needs your scientific skills. You know, I think the pandemic's really re-raised that, isn't it? We have to understand how we're modelling things. We have to understand how things change. And it's the same with climate.
Climate change, obviously, it's one of our most significant global threats that your research is contributing to. And obviously, one of the most important things that we need to do is we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to limit this global warming. But in order to be able to do that, we need to be able to monitor them and have this independent and accurate monitoring of these emissions. So this is where your research really comes in. So what emissions are you tracking and how do you do that?
Yeah, so between us, and you know, this is very much a team effort, not only at Leicester, but actually internationally. So we really work with the best in the world to do this. But we are trying to do a number of things. Actually. So first of all, we try to measure the main gases. So that's carbon dioxide and methane. But we also try to track the gases and the land surface changes that cause those changes. So there's not only emissions, but there's actually removal of emissions as well. So what we call the sources of gases and the sinks of them. So what we try to do is measure the land surface change, look at how the carbon dioxide evolves with that land surface change, use the carbon dioxide data with a model to go backwards to the emissions. So what we're measuring, if you like, is the net effect. Imagine a city and you've got everybody moving around in it, all doing their own thing, and you see the net change. So you see, for example, how many people have moved from A to B. So you're just seeing the movement, but you can use a model to backtrack to how many people left A and how many people arrived at B and how many people came from a third place C that you didn't know about. So exactly that's what we're trying to do. We put the data together with the model and say, right, how much came from Europe? How much came from Africa? How much of it was from forest or removal of forest? How much of it was from cities? It's a challenging task because the background of carbon dioxide is actually quite large. And what you're putting on top of it is quite a small perturbation. You know, in industrial times, we've gone from something like 250 parts per million to 400 parts per million. So we've close to doubled it. But that's over 100 years. So in any 1 year to year, you're seeing quite small changes. You have to be really accurate in your measurements and really good with your modelling to get back to where did that come from.
So the instruments must be really sensitive to be able to detect these changes.
They are. And not only sensitive, but you need to understand the whole process by which they measure the signals. So actually what we're doing in Space Park Leicester is we're putting in laboratories as well where we can measure the basic physics of those gases so we can understand how the signals interact with those gases? How much do they affect what we see at the satellite sensor? And then we can put that into our method to derive the concentrations back out. And the satellites themselves have to be calibrated. So they're calibrated on ground, they're calibrated in space. And people spend years arguing about how good that calibration is. It can be quite feisty sometimes, trying to agree on what really that number is so that you can use it with confidence. But the good thing is that once you have established that basic quality and accuracy, it's more or less consistent across the globe. So you're not measuring in one place and then wondering if somebody is measuring in a different place. Is that the same measurement or not? You're pretty confident that the sensor's getting the same information everywhere. And that's really useful. And if you can do that over time, then again, you're really getting that time dependence very clearly. There's fewer arguments in the end about, is this really a trend or a change?
Yeah, because that is one of the big things about climate change. It just is such a hot joke, you know, pun unintended, but such a hot topic and such a contested topic. So being able to say really accurately, no, this is really changing, is really important.
Yeah. And as you know, everyone uses the buzzwords net zero now, and that's important, but it needs a bit of unpacking. But what we can say is that if we think we're going to make changes that are going to move us on a better path towards this net zero, how will we know that we're actually doing it correctly? We tend to, at the moment, estimate it, we call it bottom up, but basically you work out how many people are using electricity, how much electricity they're each using, and you come up with some gross number at the top end. And then you work out, where did that electricity come from? Did it come from fossil fuels? Did it come from renewables? But the real question is, did it make a difference to the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? That, in the end, is the be-all and end-all. You know, there are other gases as well, but that's the crux of the matter. And so we need to see that that change that we've made in our living has really reflected itself in actual change in carbon dioxide.
And you're looking at surface temperatures as well, you were saying. So do you do that in a similar way using the satellite technology?
Yeah, we use different technologies in the sense that the carbon dioxide and the greenhouse gases tends on the whole to use more what we closer to our own visible radiation we look at. It's a little bit off the edge of that, what we call the shortwave infrared. But the surface temperature stuff is really about solid infrared that you might come across almost in your school. You probably didn't like it at school, but it's amazing how useful it becomes when you actually need it. And the surface temperature is interesting, actually, because it started off as a measure of, I suppose, what is this climate change effect? But it's moved on to also be part of the signature of impact, both of climate and of other things. So why should the surface temperature change? Well, over the oceans, it really primarily changes due to climate on the whole and circulation of the ocean secondary. If the climate changes, if we warm the climate, you should see an ocean signal that is a warming in the surface temperature. And you do. And it's great that we proved that was consistent with other people. But if you have a change in circulation, so for example, the cold water falls in a different point and with different strengths, so day after tomorrow films, all those doomsday scenarios, they're all built on changes in ocean circulation. So you should also see those effects. But when you get to land and when you get to the poles, you see a myriad of other things going on. So just take the land, you know, you walk out. If you were to look at a picture of Leicester or Leicestershire or the UK, you would see a changing pattern of urban living, house living, what we call peri-urban, mixed dwellings in urban and rural space shared. You see changes in agriculture, you change changes in tree cover. All of those manifest themselves in changes in surface temperature. It's not the same temperature pattern that we have across the country that we would have had 100 years ago. And in cities, you really see that. So there's a lot of talk. And in fact, there's an independent climate change assessment for the UK, which just highlighted again the effects of heat waves in cities and understanding that much better. So we're now getting from just measuring a basic, is the world warming, to actually what impact does that have really at a granular level, really at the level that you and I live at? And is that just due to climate or are there other things going on? Is it what we're building? Is it how we use the soil? All those things come into it. So it's really fascinating what you can see now.
Yeah, and you must be having to tease out what the possible factors are with all of this.
Yeah. So nowadays, one doesn't just talk about a single measurement often of a particular thing like temperature or greenhouse gases. Often you're saying, well, actually, I want my temperature measurement. I want a measurement of vegetation. I want some measure of human settlement. I want to know what the water flow is working. Are we getting the same soil moisture in our fields, in our trees? There's a whole sets of different variables. And so there's been a not only on the science side, research mission-wise, but actually what we call operational, so satellites that are there for a long time. A real growth in satellites because of that, looking at the Earth, different techniques. You know, some are just looking at the radiation coming from the Earth, some are pinging radiation at you and measuring that return, and they're all deriving different parameters, and we try to put them all together and try and understand it. But it's still quite complicated. Often we have to go back in the field and say, right, this is the bit we don't understand. Let's go there and see. I've never done it myself, but, you know, actually going to the poles in an aircraft, tumbling out of the back of the plane, setting up your equipment and trying to say, is this really happening the way we think it does? It's people do some incredible stuff.
It's interesting what you say, that if you can look at this on quite a localized level, which means that presumably communities could make localized responses based on some of the information that's eventually provided. I know it's a long time scale for this, but that's quite interesting to be able to look at on a local level like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is one of the opportunities. People sometimes call it challenges, but I think it's an opportunity. I think people are already doing it, actually, but at very different rates in very different places. It almost needs that spark of interest from someone to get us over the hill and actually looking at the local situation. But I think it will become much more prevalent as people can use computers much more freely, as they can access, you know, information that's publicly there. And I think there's something about how we get that information to people in ways that they can use more naturally. So Google Earth is a great example of that. I mean, it could have been done decades ago, actually, but it took someone to realize that people would just needed something they could easily click on and look at. But it's more taking it to where people are than trying to bring people to where you are. But I think there's snippets of all sorts of things, you know, sustainability, lifestyle, livelihoods, resilience to disasters. And there hopefully were some good things. You know, how do we grow our food better? You know, how do we understand the balances in what we do between, you know, planting, between building, you know, between just everyday life that we want to lead? You know, so I think that's good.
So it's a bit like monitoring the health of the planet is sort of what you're doing.
Yeah. This very phrase has been used actually by my predecessor as director of the National Center for Earth Observation. And the only thing I would say, I think, is that absolutely monitoring, but I would say it's more proactive than just monitoring as well. I mean, we really are trying to measure, and I think you used the word earlier to me, interpret, investigate, diagnose, you know, really get under the skin of what's happening. And I think that's an important passion of mine. You know, why is this the case? I'm sure my students and colleagues hate me, but, you know, I don't get this, you know, but why are we seeing this change, and, you know, or this particular pattern?
So if you've got a particular passion for a particular question you've got at the moment, then that you're kind of going, I want to understand why is that happening?
I'm really intrigued by what we do in terms of urban living, I guess, and how that's developing, how we really understand that environment. But what is really behind that, I think, as well, is I've always wanted to know why people, you know, how we can help people and what they're interested in and how this makes a difference. And when you get down to these sorts of scales, you can no longer just model and measure things as natural variations. It's not just about what this plant is doing, but there's a whole dynamic. Humans are very dynamic, I think. And how we capture that in the sort of scientific terms is really a field we've only, I think, touched the surface of. So how do you build in behavior? How do you build in people's responses to a fact? So if they think climate change is real, they might be very good at changing things. What happens if there's a disruption? I mean, that's a really live thing. So we have, in a sense, from a climate perspective, a positive disruption for a tragic reason. So the pandemic has probably improved aspects of our environment in a way that we just don't want to happen, but it is what it is at the current time. And we know that we can see that. So how do we understand that? You know, how do we make a prediction for the future? How do we adjust our living, but build in that human interaction into our model so people could do this and could do that? So it's led to this sort of concept of sort of digital twin. You can do a digital twin of your car. So before you build your car, someone builds a computer version of your car, and then they change it around and they see what it changed. So can we do the same for the world? And we already do. Your weather forecast model is really part of a digital twin, but we don't do it with the measurements, and we don't do it with these social models and these economic models tapped in. So can we embark on that now?
So tell me about Envisat then. That's for the European Space Agency, isn't it?
Yeah, so Envisat was probably the last of the big beasts, actually, in the sense that there's two ways you can do space missions. You can put all your instruments on one satellite platform, and that's really big and expensive and quite a big risk, but it really works if you can do it. Or you put each of the instruments or a small number on a whole set of satellites. But Envisat was just revolutionary because it had a whole series of instruments on it, I think about 10. And it was the size of probably bigger than a single-decker bus, but flying in space. So a single-decker bus, not that big, but you put it on a rocket and get it into space, and you've got all these instruments working by themselves autonomously. It's really exciting. So we actually were involved in two instruments on that. So the most important probably was the sea surface and land surface temperature measuring instruments. It was the third, the advanced long-track scanning radiometer that was on Envisat. But, you know, it really did mark a transition into we could do this for climate into we can do this for climate, and it sparked a lot of these applications and services. So that was really exciting time, and it actually went up just after I arrived in Leicester, so it was really exciting. But Envisat also had another instrument on it. It's what we call a Fourier transform spectrometer, which is a bit of a mouthful, but essentially it's an instrument that was invented by Michelson back in the late 1800s. And so he invented this very clever gadget where by moving two mirrors and changing the distance between them, you could get a signal that if you applied some mass to what we call the Fourier transform, you could actually get a spectrum. So it actually gave you signals as a function of wavelength, which is what we need for exactly for what we're measuring. And actually, there are a lot of these instruments around in chemistry labs, and people just use them. They're little things. But this instrument that flies in space is about 100 times better than something in a chemistry lab, but it's working hundreds of kilometers up above our head. When they first launched this instrument, they thought we would be able to measure about 7 or 8 gases. I think that was what the European Space Agency thought. This is what we could give people. We could give people data on these 7 or 8 gases. I think by the time we'd finished, and people are still working on the data, we'd done 40 gases from this instrument. So it's so flexible. And you could see things like fires. Actually, quite a lot of the world is on fire at any one time. But fires also produce a really weird mixture of gases. They produce greenhouse gases, but they produce some toxic gases. You have particles that are formed that are not necessarily good for you. You get very strong haze in Indonesia and all this sort of stuff. But you can see the effect of these fires globally. You can actually watch the fires produce gases that will go, say, from Africa to Australia. And you can see it go right across the ocean. We see Australian fires and they'll go right around the globe and come over South America. Or Canadian fires that will go over Russia and or come over us. And then you can see ammonia, hydrogen cyanide, all these things that you think, if you remember your school, you think, God, they sound nasty. And they probably, fortunately, they're in very small concentrations. But, you know, As an investigative science, there's nothing more fun than saying, oh, I've never seen this molecule before. Oh, look, there's its signature. And they're really precise signatures. It's fun. So Envisat was a remarkable experiment for us. And it spawned a whole new series of operational satellites, what we call Copernicus, which has really put Europe at the forefront of systems that people can try and put into space deliberately for long term. And we can use the data in public services for science.
I was going to ask you about Copernicus. So what does Copernicus do?
So Copernicus is actually, it's more than just satellites, but the heart of it is what they call sentinels. There are 6 satellites, multiple units of them. They cover a whole range of measurements. There are radars, there are spectrometers, there are instruments that just send out a single pulse and measure the return signal. And they'll cover everything from forestry, agriculture, ocean biology, you know, all these blooms that you sometimes see images of. There's a lot of imagery now you see on your newscast that will come from these sentinel type satellites. And around it, they put services, they put models for various things, they put emergency services. So now if there's a disaster, there are feeds of data for emergencies that people can request and use. And I think the people who've led that have really done a great service for the planet.
So there's knock-on effects to all of this as well, isn't there? So this work that you've been involved in, it's growing the space sector now. We've got Space Park, for example, which is just sort of opening on the edge of the city. It's really contributing to the UK economy as well, isn't it?
To be fair, I think we've been doing this in Leicester for a long time, actually. And so Space Park is not so much a start of something we've never done before, but the next ambitious venture on a pathway. I think over the last decade, we did some analysis, and what our research funding and regional development funding has allowed us to do is to work with about 130 companies nationally and about 55 in the Midlands region. So actually, we've interacted with a lot of people over that time. But one of the things I think we found, and I think this is common across both the Earth stuff and space technology in general, we have lots of colleagues at Leicester obviously do all those aspects, is that that close interaction between people who are doing a business and people who are doing science actually is beneficial for both. There's some skills in both areas, but there's some desires also in both. There's some clever thinking in both. And if you can bring them together under one roof and interact more, you're going to do some really neat things. And that's the hope. And I think the other thing I would say is that there's a really big change globally in space. I think people see this nationally. They see the Chinese doing stuff, the Japanese doing stuff. But I think this, how do companies work in space and what are they trying to do, has really been sparked by two things, you know, the sort of tourism bit, the Bransons and the Elon Musks, Bezos, and et cetera, et cetera. But also, I think a driver from across, but including in the States, where trying to encourage industry to take those risks and build those vehicles and do what they want to do in space. And in the Earth observation area, looking at our own planet, that's exactly what's happening. Actually, there's a company called Planet in the States, founded by an undergraduate from Leicester. And that's really been a sort of game changer industry. They put lots of satellites up, you know, small satellites, but hundreds of them, and changed the way in which satellites work. And so there are a whole series of companies now saying, well, maybe we could build something. But what their customers probably want and share with science is they want to know that this data stream isn't going to stop. And actually scientists, because of climate change, because of all these other things, want systems that don't stop. And they also want to know this quality. So we come back to that calibration question, that confidence in how good the data are. So there's actually quite a shared perspective from using those systems that applies to both the commercial and the research satellites. So it should be a fruitful area.
So you've got various roles outside the university as well, haven't you? So you're the executive director of the National Center for Earth Observation. So what does your role entail there?
Yeah, so actually that's my day job. That really does take up the bulk of my time. I'm lucky enough to do it from Leicester, so that's good. And in fact, one of the excitements of Space Park is for the first time we now have a headquarters for the National Center for Earth Observation. So been in existence in 2008, but never had a real home. And now we have a home. What it really does is it puts the work we do and the work at Leicester at the heart of a national web of really talented scientists. So I have staff in 11 universities and 3 research institutes. There's about 130, growing towards 150 of us. And we're really trying to provide that long-term capability. You know, so the stuff we know how to do takes years and years to develop. So you can't do it off a 2-year grant or a 3-year grant. You know, it's never going to work. So we try and provide that backbone, if you like, to the environmental sciences community, to people who use those sorts of data sets. And there's a big growth in environmental consultancy, in companies being aware of their targets, etc. So trying to provide that scientific knowledge. And we're funded by a research council to do it. So I do a lot of work with the research councils. You know, are we investing in the right programs? They're not just for us, it's for all the community. Do a lot of work with government departments. We're hoping to see a national space strategy launched in the near future. There is a National Space Council now, which the UK never had. In fact, I believe the Prime Minister chaired the first meeting of National Space Council. But at the end of the day, it's the science that draws me back and those talented colleagues, you know. And I was privileged enough to be in a meeting recently where we had some scientists from NASA and we had some scientists from American universities and from Japan and Australia. And we were talking about this measurement of forests. And they came up with a proposal and I said, this is great. Instead of all producing individual data sets, yes, we're going to do that. Can we come up with a synthesized data set which represents the best of our knowledge? And is that part of what we need for the Paris Agreement and for COP discussions? You know, can we produce something like that? And the willingness of people to do that was inspirational. You're back to this working internationally, but the national center bit gives you the sort of authority, I suppose, and the connectivity that people can use. And so I feel my role helps me to connect people and make things happen in a way that I couldn't do as just a single university person.
So what's been the impact of your work so far, and what's next for you?
The first thing is that we've really, you know, contributed to this new operational series of satellites called the Copernicus set of satellites. And to gauge something about what that means there's new sources of data that people can use for all sorts of things. So people use them, for example, without knowing about it. If you take a ship and it's going across the ocean, it will be using model data and observations to guide its path in oceanography. And I know the data from our sensors contributed to that in an operation where every day there's petabytes of data coming down and going into the models and that ships are using it. We've done some really nice work on looking at this temperature change in the land surface, and I'm very excited about the prospects there. But I think the, which is more subliminal in a way, just encouraging this use of this satellite data within people's policy making every day and hopefully in people's business day to day. But certainly my focus is perhaps a bit on what the government is doing and how which people are able to use that information. And I think there's still a real challenge there to enable local authorities to get hold of the data easily and to use it in their own planning, etc. So that's kind of where I'm sort of beginning to focus my sort of strategy work. You know, how do we get government to be able to use that data easily? And I, you know, all these things, that urban living, you know, and that city life and the agriculture, that's where we're really trying to make a difference.
John, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Citizen Sounds, University of Leicester. Visit le.ac.uk.